Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast, the last one before Labor Day, and I guess the semi-official end of the summer. That would be Thursday, August 29th, 2019, unofficial end of the summer. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary, and obviously I'm in a kind of scattered frame of mind today, so with me as always, and never in a scattered frame of mind, Abe Greenwald, our senior editor, even though he just said he was daydreaming. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Never daydreaming, Noah Rothman, our associate editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And off in her airy in Washington, D.C., Christine Rosen, senior writer. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
So just before we started this, the news broke that the Inspector General of the Justice Department has found that former FBI Director James Comey mishandled classified information, but mishandled his personal work product, these memos that he wrote about his meetings with Trump right after he was fired, and that he handled them inappropriately. So I guess we're going to see now a revival, a mini revival on the right of the deep state narrative that, you know, everybody in the early days of his administration and in the transition between the Obama and Trump administrations was senior officials were looking for every excuse to somehow snuff the presidency in its cradle, right? The Trump presidency in its cradle. And unfortunately for the sort of anti-Trump world, there is enough circumstantial evidence to suggest that this is true, beginning with the unmasking stuff during the transition of Michael Flynn and his phone calls and various other people to suggest at least a kind of panic among Obama-era officials that Trump as some kind of a potential or actual Russian agent was ascending to the presidency as Putin's puppet and that something needed to be done about it to the extent possible. And you remember this sort of the general's round of events. So there was this revelation that Michael Flynn, the national security advisor, had these five phone calls with the Russian ambassador and that he had then lied to Mike Pence about them. And then he was forced to resign 3 weeks into the presidency. The president fired the acting head of the Justice Department, whose name was Yates, Sally Yates, is that right? For refusing to implement his Muslim ban, or whatever we should call it, the airport ban or whatever.
He called it a Muslim ban.
Okay, so the Muslim ban. And then there was a lot of 25th Amendment talk just in the first 3 or 4 weeks. And then, of course, the stuff happened with Comey in the end of April, I believe, if I remember correctly.
Yes, April or May.
April 28th or something like that, where he, you know, asked Comey to go easy on Michael Flynn, talks to Comey, fires Comey, then talks to the visiting Russian delegation about how Comey was crazy, and then these memos that Comey had written about his experiences with Trump.
Well, he said he better be careful because what if there are tapes?
Right. Trump had said Comey better be careful about what he says because I have tapes, meaning that he had tapes.
I have them. He said I hope
there aren't any tapes.
And then these memos, the contents of these memos that Comey had written to himself about his meetings with Trump appeared on the front page of the New York Times in an article by Michael Schmidt. So that's the sort of general, and then the general run of events that surrounded the release of those memos and somebody that compelled Rod Rosenstein to appoint a special prosecutor, and that was Robert Mueller. And that's the whole sequence of events of the deep state's attack on Donald Trump that led to the supposed deep state attack that led to Mueller's appointment and then the 2 years of Mueller investigation that led to nothing, except supposedly 10 occasions of collusion or obstruction of justice relating to no collusion, right? That was the whole thing. There was no collusion, and yet Trump was obstructing justice, according to the Democrats, according to the second part of the Mueller report, blah, blah, blah. So here we have a counter narrative for the Federalist types and all this, that Comey was in fact a, you know, agent of the deep state. The thing is that I believe it's clear from the way the memos were released in the first place, and I think contemporaneously we even talked about this on the podcast, that Comey knew that he was doing something untoward, because there was this, why didn't he just release the memos? Well, he didn't own them. They weren't his property. He was an FBI director. He wrote them in his formal capacity as the FBI director. Therefore, any leaks of that was were a leak of high-level government information to the media, which is something for which I believe Peter Strzok was fired, right, from the Justice Department for having... for having done so, right, in the case of Hillary. Wasn't that, am I remembering this right? Was it Strzok or McCabe? Somebody was fired in the course of this whole balagan.
I honestly don't recall. McCabe was
for talking to the press about Hillary. Somebody was fired on the basis of the investigator general for finding out that they had talked to the press about Hillary and then lied to the inspector general. Okay, so Comey figures out a way to give these memos to a friend of his, who then give them to the New York Times as a way of somehow covering his tracks. If he was doing that, then obviously he was responsible for the leak of the memo, even though I guess one of you was telling me that Comey is on Twitter saying that he never leaked them, somebody else leaked them.
He never leaked them directly to the press, as he had been accused of doing, he says. According to the report, he indirectly...
Yeah, he gave them to a friend who gave them to Michael Schmidt, which is, you know, I mean, maybe the friend who was a professor at Columbia Law School. I can't remember who he was.
I don't remember the name, So he finds...
And he obviously talked to Ben Wittes about it. Ben Wittes, the head of the Lawfare blog, because if you remember, Ben Wittes was like, oh, it's coming out. Oh, it's going to come out. And Ben Wittes said he's a friend of Comey. So it's not like Comey wasn't revealing the contents to people. And so even at the outset of this, it was clear that Comey himself believed, if Comey could have just given a press conference and handed out the memos that he wrote, he knew he couldn't do that. So he did something wrong. Now, apparently it's not prosecutable, because apparently the inspector general just says he mishandled it or he did something inappropriate, not that he did something criminal.
He was extremely careless.
He was extremely careless, which I believe is what Comey himself said about Hillary Clinton, in that famous press conference in 2016,
which,
where he said she
was admonished by the DOJ Inspector General's office for even saying as much about something that isn't prosecutable about a private citizen, which the OIG is doing.
Doesn't both Comey's Twitter reaction today and this report both kind of reveal what many of us have long suspected about Comey, which is that he's like the Taylor Swift of law enforcement? You know, he has his like
I love Taylor Swift. By the way, like this album. I listen to it with my kids. This album, Lover, it's great. So use another example.
I'm so detached from pop culture. I can't wait to hear what that means, that he's the Taylor Swift of law enforcement.
It means the histrionic performance of one's broken love affairs, right? Ah. I mean, so she does it well, because that's what pop music is for. He does it less well with his, you know, squirreling away his memos and then, you know, coming out saying, oh, this was something I had to do because I love my country. I love the FBI. You know, arguing that it makes you a better patriot to undermine the procedures and rules of the institution of which you are the head, that's just not very persuasive. And I think that the kind of massive ego that rubbed a lot of us the wrong way not long ago is shown in full force here. And I think that at least is a useful outcome of this IG report.
Let me offer this proposition. Noah, you react to it. James Comey is the worst major public official of our time. Here's why I'm saying it. I said of our time. I'm saying he was the worst, the most inadvertently consequential major public official of our time. Arguably the person who played the leading role in the 2016 election and FBI director issuing, you know, giving a press conference, making promises that then led to the, you know, reopening of the investigation 10 days before the election. And then all of this stuff that happened that led to the appointment of the Mueller, of Mueller as a special prosecutor, thus, you know, creating this long shadow, 2-year shadow over the Trump presidency. That's a pretty bad record.
I know the question's directed at Noah, and I want to hear what Noah has to say, but it just occurred to me when you said consequential. The astounding thing is Comey has been consequential in every way that he didn't want to be and completely inconsequential in the ways he wanted to be.
To Christine's point about his vanity and solipsism, yes. Which is that maybe it doesn't really matter what he wanted or he didn't want, or he says he did want or he didn't want. His entire life revolves around his own, you know, self-obsession about what he should do and how his pride and what about him and how he's supposed to act and how he should handle things, as opposed to, that's why we have these institutional procedures as they exist, including things like, if you do an investigation of somebody like Hillary Clinton, that you close without an indictment. You don't then give a press conference that keeps the shadow lingering over her as though you indicted her without indicting her. Right. I mean, that you only do that for you. You only do that because to satisfy your own overinflated sense of self. Mueller, by contrast, did the thing. He's like, I'm going to issue a report. I'm not going to go beyond the report. I'm not going to testify. And I'm doing what I'm supposed to do here based on the rules as they stand. Right. And you're dragging me into this public hearing. And all I was supposed to do is do an investigation, make a finding, and go away. And, you know, I'm not going to get dragged into politics. And then everybody on the, you know, liberals and everybody was just enraged with Mueller, right? And even I made fun of him, but, you know, for being such an incompetent witness. But he did not want to go beyond his writ. And all Comey ever did was go beyond his writ. Noah.
No, I can't argue with that. I was spending the last few minutes trying to think of an alternative. And in terms of inadvertent consequences of actions taken with the best of intentions, but nevertheless undermining the institutions that you were stewards of, I think you could put in a good word for Susan Rice. But that's about it, and it doesn't really rise to that level.
I mean, I can't think of anybody that even comes close as an unelected public official.
In terms of the butterfly effect of the unmasking scandal.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's like more like a pterodactyl effect, you know?
Well, still, less obvious political consequences than literally getting Donald Trump elected.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a pretty big one.
So Jonah Goldberg makes the argument that and this then speaks against this, that Trump benefited in his own way from the existence of the Mueller investigation. That he, as a public official, as a public figure, needs an antagonist. So he had Hillary, and then Hillary went away, and there were no Democrats, you know, because the Democrats were so powerless in the first couple of years of the administration because the Republicans had control of the House and the Senate, that Trump is great at making Republicans antagonists or going at Republicans. That's how he got himself the nomination. But that Mueller then came along and provided him an enemy, and that the end of the Mueller report, one of the reasons that his sort of scattershot attacks over the last week concerned so many people is that, you know, they were so unfocused. Like, maybe he's trying to make Jay Powell the head of the Fed into the new Mueller or the new Hillary or something, but like, that's you know, is that really going to fly? Like, he appointed Powell, and what Powell's doing is arguably, maybe it's unimaginative, maybe it's not all that helpful to the economy, but it's certainly well within the, you know, understanding, it's well within the way the Fed chairman is supposed to react. And does anybody really understand what it is that Powell's doing wrong and all that? So that's sort of interesting, not that I don't think he really benefited from the Mueller investigation, but it, as I say, at least gave him a target, and now maybe he can have Comey for a target for another couple of weeks.
Yeah, no, sure his comfort zone is Republicans and conservatives, and that's where they're going to go if he loses in 2020. That the reason why Donald Trump lost Florida in this hypothetical is because conservative bloggers lacked sufficient zeal in his defense. It's impossible to prove, which is why it's so valuable as
a narrative. This is a speculative scenario.
Right.
You're drawing.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. I mean, in the event that he were to lose re-election. Because that's what energized his base in 2016. The stabbed in the back narrative is going to be it cannot be falsified, which is why it is so beneficial and so comforting. Democrats are not going to be his targets. It's going to be another internecine war, which is really where all the energy is. Everybody likes that fight.
And the left loves it, right? The right likes it because it's sort of a self-obsessive, navel-gazing, civil war, you know, bloody civil war thing. And the left likes it because they love to see Republicans killing each other. So, so there'll be absolutely no resistance to that, if that were to happen.
The squad also had the same effect, take Jonah's point, of focusing the otherwise chaotic aspect of Trump's ire.
Right, but
It really didn't
well,
take.
Well, it takes. I don't agree. I think it takes, but they have to keep feeding. He needs things to react against. They seem to have gone to ground over the last couple of weeks.
It works if it's Ilhan Omar. It works if it's AOC. It doesn't work if it's a quadrumvirate or whatever the word
No, but
would be,
okay,
quartet.
so the last one has to be a was Omar and Tlaib together, then there's AOC and but I mean, it's also there is that punching down effect question, which is so he's doing that, but he's not attacking Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi is the Democrat with all the power. But in any case, I think what we can wonder about as we go into September is something that the news over the last week, 10 days, has not been good for Trump, right? So there's been the GDP numbers came out and for the second quarter, and they're 2%, right, which is an Obama level number. They were revised downward, below 3% already. The job creation numbers and the unemployment numbers have been revised downward. There is all this talk about the inverted yield curve, the trade war. Interest rates are falling like crazy all over the place. My wife and I had to look, we had to have yet another one of these conversations, but whether refinance our mortgage because rates are falling so precipitously, which is really bad for anybody who has any savings. There are these there are both current bad signs and future bad signs, and then all this stuff where he attacks Powell, and he says Powell's like, worse than Xi and all of that. And then he gets, and then... As Abe said, as always happens, what happens here?
In these sort of big headline news cycles, there's always a sort of decisive announcement that breaks in favor of Trump and against the anti-Trumpers. And it's been happening sort of, with the so-called collusion scandal all the way through. And the maddening thing has got to be, if you oppose Trump in this, that all the content of everything we know about Trump and Russia and the investigations is bad for him. It makes him look unseemly, surrounded by unseemly people, so all sorts of really bad decisions and motivations at work, and yet every decisive headline kind of gets him off.
There was more Putin stuff at the G8, right? He sat there and had these fights at the G8 with the other heads of the of the Western economies about why they wouldn't let Putin back in. He wants to let Putin back in. Putin was removed from the G8 because of invasion of Ukraine, which Trump really doesn't care about. And so that's another moment at which that leads to So then there's what you're talking about, and then there's the wild overreaction that leads to things like Lawrence O'Donnell going on MSNBC saying he now has evidence that the Russians were backing Trump loans at Deutsche Bank or Wells Fargo or one of those banks, and then he had to retract the story. That Trump and the Fed and the guy Dudley, the guy who had been a Fed official, writing this op-ed in Bloomberg earlier in the week, basically saying the Fed should do what it use its power to make sure that Trump doesn't get reelected. Now, the piece itself made an argument about how the Fed shouldn't go along with Trump for proper reasons. And then it sort of ends with, you know, we can't have a trade war. He's doing it. We have to stop him by any means necessary. So you have a major official at the Fed saying the Fed should former official, but a major former official at the Fed saying the Fed should intervene and use its powers to change the results of the 2020 election. And Lawrence O'Donnell having to retract a story about how Trump, you know, was getting money from Russia. And it just, it's like it's that thing. He drives them into behavior that discredits the anti-Trump cause.
Right. But meanwhile, what Trump really should be listening to are his fellow Republicans who have, you know, long had concerns and anxieties about where the economy's headed and particularly about this trade war with China, but who had kept quiet until now. And now that, you know, as you said, there are some signs that the economy might be slowing or, you know, the inverted yield curve, et cetera, et cetera. Well, you know, Pat Toomey is now saying, you know,
Senator
gee, maybe
from
we
Pennsylvania.
Should. Exactly. So he's, you know, we have some more prominent Republicans now speaking out about their own concerns. And of course they will. They're about to, many of them are about to face re-election. And you don't want to be facing re-election when there are all kinds of anxieties and questions about the economy. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, they've been trying to get him to ease up on this China trade war. So if he was smart about this, he would be listening to the people in his own party who have their own electoral hopes on the line here. But in some ways, the kind of wild overreaction on the Lawrence O'Donnells and others of the world distracts from that more important conversation that we could be having and absolutely important pointed criticisms of the policies that the Trump administration is pursuing and their impact on the economy.
I think we risk overinflating the extent to which anybody cares about any of this. I don't think James Comey translates to average voters. I don't think it dominates a news cycle. I don't think anybody's reading Bloomberg op-eds from the former Fed chair looking for deep state conspiracy theories, as though a deep state conspiracy theory writes an op-ed in Bloomberg to announce it. I think this is August stuff, and the economy is eclipsing all of this, and it's going to become a fundamentals election in the next couple of news cycles very soon. Because we're winnowing the field, and it's going to pretty soon become a field of about four Democrats, and you'll have a race on records pretty soon.
Okay, but you know the problem with the, you know, no one pays any attention to, you know, the details as they go along is you're right. I mean, Dudley's op-ed will be forgotten very soon, but it matters day by day what the general stress, what the general conversation is about, because that helps shape the conversation on the following day and the day after that and the questions that get asked, say, in the next Democratic debate, which is going to be obviously far more consequential than these earlier debates because there's going to be one stage, 10 people. Biden will be now finally facing Warren and Sanders head-to-head, and it'll be interesting to see. They're obviously going to go right at his jugular, and the question is, will he go right back at theirs? Will we have an ideological battle on the stage about, say, the question of, you know, socialized medicine or various other things? But I just want to, I pointed this out to you guys a couple days ago, and it really is staggering because no one had quantified it this way. A guy named Mike Gerke on Twitter, this is the tweet. The exit ramp of 293 Republicans serving in Congress, that's Senate and House, when Trump became president. 14 left office early in 2017-18. 34 did not seek re-election in 18. 2 lost primaries in 18. 30 lost to Democrats in 18. 2 are leaving office early in 1920. I think that's now 3, actually, because of the very sad departure of
Sean Duffy.
Johnny Isaacson, who has Parkinson's.
Sean Duffy's also sad.
And Sean Duffy's sad because apparently they have a, an unborn child that may have health challenges, he and his wife Rachel. And 11 will not seek re-election in 20. So if you add all this up, and Justin Amash changing parties or leaving the Republican Party, that is 94 Republicans out of 293 that were serving when Trump got elected. That's 32.1% of all Republicans in Congress who will not be in Congress by the end of Trump's first term. That's an astounding number. That's defeats, retirements, whatever. Now that number is, you'd have to look back and try to calculate the same number under Obama. Actually, I think it was probably higher under Obama because Obama lost more House over the 8 years of Obama. He lost at least, more than 100 probably, but this is 2.5 years. That's bad, and that's the kind of evidence that Trump, like Obama, will be seen maybe as having been really parlously bad for his party. Remember, Trump came in, lost the House in 18, which is both this not an unexpected thing for a sitting president to lose the House in a midterm. But he's not done his party any favors, certainly. And this suggests that he's done worse than not doing his party any favors. And then there's the question of whether or not the survival instinct will kick in among these Republicans. And like Christine suggests, maybe they will go en masse to him and say, save us. We're going down. If we go down, you're going down too. Because don't think that somehow... if they successfully go after us district after district, that you're going to do well in our district, and you lose 12 or 14 of the congressional districts that you won in 2016, and you're toast. Or they're just too scared because he'll attack them and raise the specter of a primary challenge, and then they'll just
retire.
That
only works until primaries are over.
Which?
The Republicans who are afraid of a Trump tweet, that's effective only as long as the filing for a primary challenge is open. And once that closes, then that forecloses on that threat, and everybody has to run their own race.
No, money. They've got problems raising money if Trump goes after them, because then the RNC won't help and the NRCC won't help and stuff.
Well,
like
it's,
that.
Isn't it? At a certain point, I understand that, but at a certain point, you triage races. The RNC is one animal. The NRSC and the NRCC are something else.
Anyway, go ahead, Christine. Sorry.
I was going to say the other thing that we should keep in mind, not just in terms of the kind of decimation of conservative principles and whether or not the Republican Party will even be anything but a shell by the time Trump exits the White House, is that a lot of what he's doing is also contributing to the radicalization of the left. And so you're going to have a Democratic Party that comes out of this much, much more powerful and much more radicalized than it was even 8 years ago.
Okay, but now let's turn to... So Kristen Gillibrand dropped out of the race, right, yesterday. And let's turn to this question of how radicalized the Democratic Party has been, because her bet running as a candidate was that what she was going to do is get as far to the left, especially culturally, as she possibly could, and run from there. And it didn't take at all. Apparently, in the last poll somewhere or other, she did not get a single respondent to say that they were going to vote for her. Like, zero respondents. So, and there's Biden, and as I wrote in the New York Post today, Biden... 4.5 months now, there have been 68 polls since the beginning of April in which he has led, and in a vast majority of them by double digits. And there was one poll this week of 298 Democrats nationwide in which he, Sanders, and Warren were tied. And the pollster himself came out with a statement saying that the poll was an outlier, clearly, because after that poll came out, four different national polls came out that showed Biden ahead by 10 points, around 30%. So
Gillibrand, I'm just
go ahead.
Interjecting. Gillibrand's bet was that the Democratic Party was radicalized along identity politics lines, and that her famous pitch is that you have to teach your sons that they would be shot more frequently if they were black. That didn't attract a lot of voters, surprise, surprise. But the notion that Democrats are not radicalized because Joe Biden commands the support of a third of them is dubious, because another third of them support, perhaps more than a third, depending on the poll, support Bernie and Elizabeth. And Bernie's Axios has a great piece on Bernie's plans, which gives the top line on some of his policy plans, which are, it says, essentially are designed to remake every aspect of American society, and they ain't lying. Among them, his Green New Deal proposal, which would spend approximately $16 trillion, which is just money that doesn't exist, to remake the American economy from the ground up. His plan is to eliminate gas-powered cars in 10 years, to eliminate private health insurance, to eliminate student debt, to eliminate tuitions for state colleges, to hire more teachers and fund better schools, to promise full employment for everybody, a federal jobs guarantee, to guarantee you at least $15 per hour for those jobs, to increase the taxes by an undetermined amount, but impose substantial tax increases on the wealthiest owners, and consumption taxes. And so all of this is really quite radical, and it appeals to a substantial majority of Democrats. So even if Bernie Sanders were, or sorry, Joe Biden were to win the nomination, he still inherits a party that is composed of these people and who will staff his administration.
Okay, I'm looking here at 2016, okay? Bernie Sanders got 43% of the overall Democratic primary vote in 2016. So I don't know how you can then say that Trump came in and everything is way more radical than it was before. I mean, he's still Bernie Sanders. Like, he's the same guy. I mean, maybe these policy proposals weren't as spelled out in 2016 as they were now, but he was the socialist running for president. He got 13.2 million votes overall against Hillary Clinton, who got 17 million votes. So
that was a different dynamic, though. That was a, he was an alternative to Hillary Clinton. This is an affirmative choice for Bernie Sanders.
Okay, but he's only getting 12 to 17% of the primary vote. It still matters. I'm not saying that, you know, Biden is sitting there like, you know, getting 70% of the vote and therefore the party isn't, you know, further to the left. It's just that you're the one who says that there's a difference between Twitter and reality, and the left, the thing that is being challenged by the by Biden's refusal to collapse is the Twitter view that the Democratic Party has moved so crazily, is like, you know, basically, you know, the international is the socialist international.
But
maybe it isn't.
But even with Biden, throughout he has to pay a certain obedience to the radical elements on the left. I mean, he's out there pretending that being tough on crime is a bad thing. Just the other day, he made some statement about, I don't even know the details anymore, about how white Americans are responsible for some sort of raft of evils, and so on. So in some sense, it's because it's become sort of the radical stuff has become subsumed into the party and the liberal left generally. It's kind of hard to tease out.
If we're talking about polls for Biden suggesting that he commands about a third of the vote, and that's pretty static, then you can't ignore the one-fifth to one-third that gravitates towards the progressive camp, which is going to make up a substantial portion of his support, and all of their woke online staffers who will man departments under the Biden administration, who will staff his White House and the West Wing. I mean, these are the people who will be in charge.
Look, I agree. I'm just saying that the general narrative of the last 6 weeks has been the following, which is that Biden should be collapsing. He did terribly in the first debate. Kamala Harris threw him on his heels in the conversation about busing, and he keeps forgetting. He keeps saying that he said that Vermont was New Hampshire, and he said that he was vice president during Parkland. And so this, you know, implicit idea that he's senile or has lost his, you know, was lost his crap, and so he should, everybody should be.
Well, that was a lot of the wishfathering, the thought from a press that sides mostly with progressives.
That's what I'm saying.
Overtly or right. Implicitly or explicitly. Right. But what really did hurt him was busing controversy.
But in the end, it didn't. You know why it didn't? Because if we're really, that was 1971. It was 1971 that we're talking about. I mean, this is insane. You're going to literally try to have Kamala Harris make her bones against Biden by talking about a policy issue that was won by the other side by the late 1970s? Do you realize how long ago the late 1970s were? I mean, it's like nobody even knew what the hell she was talking about. The whole thing was hot air on the part of woke reporters who think that black people should be voting 90% for Kamala Harris or Cory Booker because she's black and they're black.
Now,
and as it turns out, he's getting an absolute majority in the polls of the black vote, and they're not.
Now,
and
here's what's interesting about that, though.
Okay.
Joe Biden's campaign manager goes on MSNBC the other day and delivers a direct broadside at Elizabeth Warren, saying, and Bernie Sanders, saying, and I'm paraphrasing because I don't remember exactly what he said, but this is, you cannot win the Democratic Party's nomination, nor should you, without the support of African-American voters. You cannot win this nomination with just white liberals, which is an implicit attack on the progressives for whom their support, their base of support, is educated, affluent, and white.
But it's the perfect attack against them because they cannot disagree.
They can't disagree, and it's almost emotionally manipulative. it's almost emotional blackmail.
That's why it's so fantastic. What a great political play if you think about it.
He's doing it from a position of strength.
Right.
So it's like it really is like emotional blackmail, and it suggests it could actually shut them up.
Because it's also like got this quality of, you know, you're also kind of, you're sitting around saying that everything you care about is what you care about. Well, you know, African Americans don't care about what you care about. You know,
there are so
senators from Vermont and Massachusetts, like, they don't care about any of this stuff. You know, they like Medicare. They don't, you know, they don't need you mucking around with government health insurance. They like it fine, or however you want to look at it, including that. You know, those communities, particularly as they get older, are not particularly socially woke, you know. But who knows why they like Biden or what. I'm just saying what's interesting to me was the presumption that there was going to be this debate and Kamala Harris was going to say, I was a little black girl being put on a bus in Berkeley and you tried to stop it, right? And that everyone's going to hear this and go, oh, right, she's black, he's white, now we're for her. Because that's how identity politics is supposed to work, and we're now all identity politicians. So the presumption of the working press is that Cory Booker and Kamala Harris should have the black vote in their pocket. And so far it's not happening. And I would have to say, in Harris's case, I don't think it's going to happen because she had her moment. She had a week in which to use, you know, that debate performance to make a real move on the voters that she needed, and she didn't do it because she's bad.
But
she's really not good at this.
But that's why she hurt Biden in the polls. We saw it.
She hurt him, and it was evanescent.
And it was evanescent because she is terrible on defense. She couldn't maintain the attack.
Well,
on offense, she's good.
No.
She lands a couple of blows. She couldn't defend her position when she was pressed on it.
Well, because you should never defend your position. You should keep going on the attack. But, you know, it could be, honestly, that she had this moment and all this, but that, you know, it's older African Americans who are Biden's, who are the core of Biden's national support, apparently. And older African Americans, like older Americans who are old enough to remember busing, nobody liked busing. Black people didn't like busing, and white people didn't like busing. Black people didn't want their kids sent an hour away into a white school where they were going to be made to feel uncomfortable and alien and feel weird.
Or the magnet schools that took away seats from their kids.
Whatever. There were hardly any magnet schools at the time, as it happens in the 70s. And so there was no, this was a wildly unpopular policy. Only people who knew nothing about it and are drenched in the politics of our moment could think that it was a wise political decision to raise busing as something that would hurt Biden with the very voters that Kamala Harris needs to jump from him to her to make her candidacy viable, I think.
Well, I think this is what's going to make the next debate interesting, but to have both Warren and Biden on the same stage and to see how much each of them talk about race, because Warren's really struggled with black voters. She has not been successful in getting many of them to support her candidacy. Biden, as we said, has got a pretty firm base there, but I wonder how much that's going to impact this next debate, and then to watch Harris and Booker respond to however they want to frame that debate.
Right. Now, so I think part of the problem here is that you have three or four candidates who can't rise much higher because they're also going for the same white progressive vote. And there isn't, you know, and according to these polls that we saw, the, you know, people who define themselves as moderate or conservative make up a majority of Democratic primary voters, like 53, 54, 55%. So you have Harris, you have Warren, you have Sanders, you have Pete Buttigieg, who is even more a kind of you know, college educated, he is the personification of the very voter who likes him, right? He's like a little under 40. He's gay. He's well-spoken. He's like what they would want to be. Beto O'Rourke is sort of the same guy, even though, you know, they're all fighting for an actual sliver of the base that isn't large enough. You know, if everybody got out but one of them, you know, if everybody got out but Warren, maybe she could agglomerate their white, liberal, college-educated vote.
It's sort of like a mirror image problem of what Republicans dealt with in 2016, where the consultant class and the people on cable news and the people who write and they sell a corridor have no idea what the party consists of.
Right. But I really think that the story here relating to 2015, 2016 is precisely that we are sitting here staring in the face the fact that since April, Biden is at least 10 to 15 points up on everybody else. And everybody wants to pretend that it's not there. Just like Trump got in the lead after a month, after June 16th, he never surrendered it. And we sat here and everybody sat there going, well, he'll fade. He's going to go away. You know, people, all the contradictions are going to come out. And at some point, you know, the evidence of your own eyes has to, you know, the wish's father can't be father to the thought when, you know, as I said, 68, one poll out of the last 68 didn't have Biden up by at least two. And I think 45 of those 68 had him in double digits.
Oh, but what about the crowds?
Oh yes, the crowd. She got a crowd in Seattle. In Seattle, like if she can't get a crowd in Seattle, yeah. If Elizabeth Warren shot somebody, at Pike Place Market, nobody, you know, her supporters wouldn't, you know.
I mean, so the logic of it is that think about 2008, right? Barack Obama struggled until he won Iowa out of the blue, and from then it was a grudge match all the way into April, but he was destined to be the victor, and at a certain point, Hillary Clinton was finished and didn't acknowledge it. So there's a precedent for this sort of thing. But Biden's ahead in Iowa.
Biden's ahead in Iowa? Biden's ahead in New Hampshire?
By a substantial lead. I mean, Iowa's a must win for
Elizabeth And it's for, a bad state for
Elizabeth Warren.
Nate Silver tells
Warren,
me.
It's a must win because it's a progressive state and it's a white state, and that's her state. Yeah. She can't pull that off.
Yeah. Nate Silver tells me that Iowa should be a bad state for Biden. The question is when Iowans are going to decide that it's a bad state for Biden. Now, he's not doing as well there as he is nationally, but he's at 27%. He's 32% nationally.
There's also apparently this caucus from home situation.
They're not doing it, supposedly. Right. Yeah, there was a whole
that
idea
just
about
be the end of the caucus dynamic.
Yeah, doing a virtual caucus.
Right.
which clearly isn't going to happen. But Biden is ahead in all four of the early states. He's ahead in Nevada. He's ahead in South Carolina. He's ahead in South Carolina by 30. He's ahead in New Hampshire, and he's ahead in Iowa. Now, at some point, that could stop. There's no question that it could stop. But I'm asking, given the solidity of all of this, doesn't what stops him have to be kind of dramatic? It's not going to be Elizabeth Warren issuing another proposal. You know?
God help
us. And it's not going to be Bernie Sanders punching a punching bag until it hits him in the head. Like, all these hilarious YouTube videos of Bernie Sanders, like, throwing a baseball and hitting a ball and punching a punching bag in order to show that he's, you know, spryer than Joe Biden. And then they finally got the one of him punching the punching bag, and the punching bag came back and hit him in the forehead. It was fantastic. Anyway, I mean, just these kind of stunts, like, something's got to happen.
But I think it's going to be by Biden's own hand, right? I
mean, if something happens.
Right, if something happens. Yeah.
But it can't just
slip.
Be.
He's going to crumble somehow.
Yeah, but remember, that was what we said about Trump. Trump was going to crumble somehow too, right? It was going to happen. Trump was going to crumble. And Rubio was going to be there to pick up the pieces. That was the general sotto voce thought, right, of the political class was. And, you know, sure, it could happen. I mean, it's 5 months till anybody casts a vote. I'm not saying Biden can't lose. Anybody can lose anything.
Right.
Yeah, but getting back to the economy point we were talking about earlier, there have been some recent, I think it was a Quinnipiac poll recently about voter attitudes, and among conservatives and Republican-leaning voters, for the first time, there's concern about how Trump is handling the economy, expressed in polls. Like, but up till now, it's not been that dramatic, but we're seeing. So it's, I mean, Trump does not look like a strong candidate going into this race, which we forget because he did, have such an upset in the last one. But I think Biden might have to mess up, but almost either Biden or Warren is still got a pretty commanding lead ahead of Trump right now going into the election, whichever the nominee is. I mean, he's looking very weak even among his supporters.
Right. The only thing that I think leads us to believe that he's stronger than he appears is two pieces of historical data. There's a piece of historical data, which is that Obama was hovering around these numbers, around the same time, 42, 43, 44%. And so he looked weak. And of course, he actually won an absolute majority. Though to be fair, Obama got 70 million votes in 2008 and 66 million in 2012. So it's not like he did not suffer. He did not, he came off as high. And of course, Trump can't afford to lose a single vote, and he needs to get some more, partially because of natural population growth, and then partially to offset whatever advances the Democrats make in the very places that he won. So that's one piece of data. And the other is just this idea that the Democrats are just too far left to win. Like, they're arguing things and pushing things and obsessed with things that do not speak to the concerns of most voters.
Well, this is also going to become a self-fulfilling prophecy, because what the Trump campaign is going to have to do is what Barack Obama's campaign did, which is scorch the earth and render their opponent toxic in order to prevent a referendum up or down on their policies.
Right.
And that's going, and the attack is going to be, they're too crazy, they're too far left, they're too racially obsessed, even if it's Joe Biden. And that scorched earth campaign in 2012 had the reciprocal effect on the Republican Party of transforming them into precisely what the caricature was.
Right.
And that's what we're going to get in the event that Donald Trump is successful in the effort to caricature Democrats.
So what I'm back to the argument that we were having about whether or not, Biden and Warren represented, the leftward march of the party or not. And I'm saying that there's some evidence that, the party doesn't want to march as far left as they are. Biden is that evidence. But I do agree that you could have the bizarre effect of their loss will strengthen their ideological rump. I think that's what you're saying. That should be counterintuitive, that if you lose a national election because you're too far left, the last thing you should do is go further left. But it could well happen, and particularly happen if Biden is the nominee. Because, of course, if Biden's the nominee and he loses, then it's like, well, what did we go for that for?
Right.
What did we go for the moderate alternative when he lost? That's the Romney argument, right?
Right. That's always the argument. They said we should go to the middle of the road. They said play it safe. You know, what good does that do?
Yeah. But, of course, Trump, the idea that Trump then violated that proposition isn't true, because of course he was less conservative on all sorts of issues, or anti-conservative or whatever on a whole range of issues, and guys like Henry Olson would say that it was Trump's violation of Republican conservative principles that won him the election, right?
Less conservative but more extreme.
Exactly.
Just irascible, though.
No, but I think, right, but his irascibility was the... That's the, we don't get anything by being, you know, we might as well be as nasty as they say we are, because we get nothing from, you know, look at this nice guy. He was a wimp. You know, he didn't fight. He didn't do anything. Romney, you know.
Right. I mean, you already hear it from Democrats. It's the same line that Republicans use. You know, everything we do is going to be called racist. So what the heck? Everything we do is going to be called socialist. So why not go full bore?
I just want to close... Christine, talking a little bit about your the blog post that you wrote on, you know, on what is, I think, inarguably the most outrageous public policy proposal of the year, which is here in New York City, which is the panel assembled by Bill de Blasio that is arguing that all magnets, gifted and talented programs in New York City schools should be ended and eliminated in order to further getting a proper integrationist balance into the local school system.
Yeah, this is the idea that anything that sorts students by merit or testing is called now an exclusionary admissions process, right? I mean, this idea that because certain groups, or the wrong minorities, we should say, because Asian Americans are doing quite well on the exam to get into these elite high schools and into these gifted and talented programs, just Hispanic and African American students are not. And all of this, of course, wrapped in the great irony that Bill de Blasio's own son went to one of these competitive schools as a high school student. He then went on to Yale from there. And the idea that de Blasio wants to absolutely destroy a system that his own children benefited from is, of course, will surprise no one in New York, I'm sure, but was very surprising to me. We'll see what he decides to do, but this idea that leveling should be the response when there's not equality of outcome is really pernicious, and I think, unfortunately, likely to be the future of a lot of these merit-based and competitively tested admissions processes.
Right.
It's really bad for New York students.
Right. So the story in New York is that there was no such thing as gifted and talented programs until the 1970s. Why? New York City had a fantastically good public school system until the 1960s. And so there were better and worse high schools, and a lot people almost went to them at will, because you were either academically minded, in say like my father or something, you know, in the 1930s and 1940s, you were either academically minded and interested in going off to college, or you weren't. And if you weren't, there were other alternatives, including trade schools and famous automotive school in Brooklyn and various other things that you could do, or you could go to an academically minded high school. But that in schools themselves, New York City had this famously good public school system that could encompass all kinds of different students, including good and bad and otherwise. And then the system fell apart. And it fell apart for interesting sociological reasons, the key reason being that the lion's share of teachers in the New York City public school systems were Jews, who were denied access to other forms of good intellectual, you know, academic employment until the 1960s. And once that was no longer the case and people like that could get jobs elsewhere, they got jobs elsewhere. And that entire cohort, including women, by the way, then there were also the fact that, you know, this is an area in which women who wanted to work could work, right? And they didn't, a lot of school systems required that married women no longer teach, but that was not true, you know, of the New York City school system anyway. So it all fell apart, and the schools plunged in like 6 or 7 years into disaster. And then beginning in the 1970s, they started this this testing system for the high schools that then became a sort of national model. There's this one test, you take it, there are eight schools, nobody knows, and your grades don't matter, nothing that you've done before eighth grade matters, only the score on this test then lets you into Bronx High School of Science or Stuyvesant or Brooklyn Tech or their various other schools. And the idea is that that's as blind as you can possibly make an admissions process, right? There's no way that you could make it blinder. Nothing matters. Your name doesn't matter. There's no political lobbying, nothing, right? It's just that number. Okay, well, then you have the problem, which is as time goes on, then it turns out that you can study for the test and, you know, either you study for the test or you don't, then more affluent people get tutors and they study for the test, and then less affluent Asian kids who are willing to stay up till 3 a.m. study for the test with books, and then they get in, and then there is this result, which is like horrifying, right? Which is that in the, as of last year, the year before last, nine African American kids got into a class of 900 at Stuyvesant. So here's the question: what's the fault here? Is the fault, so if New York hadn't had its school system collapse, there would have been way more kids than nine. There were way more kids than nine when my sister went to Bronx Science as one of the first kids in the testing regime in the early 1970s. Why did the Asian kids do well? Because the Asian kids like work their asses off and study and try to and look at this as their main chance. And what's going to happen when you, and this now, so then the gifted and talented programs then, you know, leach down into the elementary schools and charter schools and all of that. And so the whole point here is that there used to be considered the notion that it was to the good of the country that you educated the next generation, not only for their own sake, but for the country's sake. So you made sure that you had people who were going to innovate, you know, make scientific discoveries, write great books, you know, go into politics, be engineers, however you want to slice it. That's what schooling is for. It's not just to warehouse kids till they're 18 in, you know, in proper ethnic balance. It's to help the country locate the next set of people who will, and to make sure that everybody in the country has a chance to, has at least a chance from the outset to excel if they can. And now you're just throwing in the towel and saying it's never going to be fair. The outcome's never going to be fair, as Christine said. So the only thing to do is to get rid of the outcome. You know? That is the logic of our present moment and the logic of identity politics. And then everybody goes along with it except the parents who are panicked. So what are they going to do? White flight ended in New York when the crime rate dropped, and it will go back. They'll be, you know, if you make it impossible to believe that your kid can get a decent education, you have to move out of the city.
Asian parents are also mounting legal challenges.
I think in the end, de Blasio is first of all, he's term limited, so he could do it. This is such a huge thing for him, and he's actually a coward and a corrupt. You know, somebody came in to be big left wing, and then he just, you know, he sold $100 million weird real estate deals that he should have been indicted for and stuff like that. He's just a lazy, corrupt, garbage politician, and he won't want to face this. It's too controversial even for him, I think. That said,
I was just going to add that for most of these Asian American students who are getting in, these are not wealthy, privileged kids.
No, they're the poorest kids in New York City.
Bangladeshi. I mean, yeah, they are. Yeah. And they work so hard. And it's speaking to that culture of achievement and noting that the achievement gap begins 0 to 5. Like by the time kids enter kindergarten, that achievement gap exists. So the idea that you have to abolish merit-based programs in high school and eliminate these achievement-oriented high schools is ridiculous. If you really want to address the problem, it's got to start really early. early. And like you said, it's going to be a difficult conversation to have, honestly.
Well, we haven't. We can't have it. I mean, we can't have it. So the choice has been, for social peace, has been not to have it.
Right.
See, I mean, that has been the choice. The choice has been, this has gone on, schools got better, everybody, you know, there were a place for people in more affluent neighborhoods, the schools got better, and we weren't going to have this conversation because it's ugly and unpleasant, and it makes everybody feel bad. And there is a problem. Abe, who did a big piece on you know, Asian America, the war on Asian Americans, there is a problem with our meritocratic, with this these channelings. It's not like one we're going to sit here and say it's all great. There is a social issue that is created by the idea that beginning in, you know, first grade, there are two levels of children.
Yeah, and it gets reinforced every step of the way, and there are all sorts of ways for parents with means to sort of game the system. I mean, a lot of the test preparation stuff, some of it is sort of legitimate in that it teaches in the traditional sense of the word. It teaches sort of knowledge and how to think and how to approach problems in a way that's, I guess, for your better for your sort of general ability to function. But a lot of the test preparation is sort of tricks. It's sort of backdoor tricks. How to a question like this really means this, and think of it in this completely sort of coded way. That doesn't require that. That is no test of intelligence or how to process information.
Well, there is the fantastic. There's a student-led journalism project in Los Angeles that was just published by a site called LAist that said, here's the gaming. You are 77 times more likely, if you come from an affluent school district, to have the school have a ruling that says that you need more time on tests. It's a disability finding that says you have ADHD or you have dyslexia or something like that. So if you are from, you know, a high-end zip code, you are 77 times more likely to get another hour to take your test than you are if you live in East LA.
Exactly.
That's gross, and that's horrendous and horrific, and that's how the system, because you understand the theory, right, that says that obviously someone with dyslexia can't take the test as effectively in 3 hours. But then you get somebody gets a false, you know, gets somebody to, you pay, you do the Rick Singer thing and you pay them $1,000, say your kid is dyslexic, and then you get extra time. Now,
this dovetails with another Christine piece that she posted today about the SAT's attempt to institutionalize
adversity,
right? Sort of the notion that you are the sum of your experiences, and as a result of income disparities, racial disparities, neighborhood disparities, primarily affecting minority children, then we should factor that into your test score and essentially create a whole nother metric by which we gauge students on aptitude.
And that theory,
which is it's a negative score.
But I mean, in that case, you're
pursuing not aptitude but disadvantage. That's what gets you through life, which is also easily gained.
But that's the theory. I think the theory is, the theory that rules that is, there are all these natural advantages to being affluent. So you need to create
a standardized test.
No, but you need to set them off by having your disadvantage provide you with an advantage to somehow.
I mean, that was the whole theory of the standardized test, was that it erased individual circumstances. Now the theory is that we have to not only erase them, but highlight these individual circumstances and correct for them based on subjective criteria.
Look, this is an incredibly unfair, there is no way to correct for anything, right? So there is a way to correct for anything. The idea behind, say, the testing into the New York City public school, the selective public high schools, is this is the best you can do. I mean, how much better can you do than by making the people who by eliminating choice from the selection process? All there is a number. Your grades, teacher recs, all the stuff that colleges use, none of that is there, so that it eliminates at least 7/8 of the way in which you can game the system. And then there's only this. But yeah, it can be gamed some, but at least all these other aspects that can be gamed more effectively no longer play a part. So you're asking to eliminate human nature and actual, and then of course the problem is that there are actual differences, as it turns out. They're, I think, mostly cultural, but yeah, so Asian Americans, like Jews of a previous era, believe that the only way out of your circumstances is through getting a good education. Christine, on the adversity score thing, aren't you a little shocked that they gave up on it so fast?
No, not at all. They've just rebranded it. It's still there. It's just they've rebranded it because they got so much pushback about the whole adversity score thing, that all they're doing is calling it landscape and not giving it a singular number. But all the same data is being harvested and used and sent with the score. And the only other difference is that now the students themselves can actually see what their sort of landscape portrait is. But basically, it's all the same stuff. It's, you know, neighborhood. It's, you know, they look at your high school and see how many kids were eligible for federally subsidized lunches. You know, it's all the same data. It's just being rebranded. That was my take on it. So I don't, you know, so despite all the kind of, we're humbled by the criticism that the president of the College Board claimed to have told the New York Times, I think they're just trying to find a way to give the same information with a slightly kinder, gentler name.
Right, but they thought that was kind and gentle. That's why they went with it in the first place. I think that was the surprise. A lot of this is, again, every now and then, I think we are surprised that the kind of views that we espouse, you know, there is public support for them, or that they we think they're common sense, but sometimes it feels like the country has now lost any connection it had to, you know, common sense. And finally, you know, Lori Loughlin, not to get back to my favorite story of all time, but, you know, Lori Loughlin went to court this week, right, I don't know what they were talking about, their lawyers, she and her husband, and what lawyers were going to represent them. So she was in court, and see, here's the interesting thing about the Lori Loughlin case, of which I can't get enough. Nonetheless, like, it too is a weird thing where you have the Justice Department, you have a national legal process that is there, you know, archly defending the system of admissions against, you know, encroachment by this evil system of, you know, bribery and all of that. Why? I mean, somehow every now and then you get this moment, you think, why is this anybody's business? So yeah, if she had given if they'd given $5 million for a building instead of $500,000 to a fake foundation, nobody would say boo about them buying their, you know, I mean, people would say, oh, it's not fair, and, you know, inequality and all of that. But every now and then you get this moment of like, why is it that the Justice Department is defending the arguably repugnant system by which these universities choose their undergraduates? I mean, maybe it's good because it exposes the repugnant legal part as well as the evil part, but I don't know. Like, she's really going to go to jail for years because she wanted to get her kid into a college? Really? I don't know. Anybody, Christy, am I being crazy?
No, I mean, I think the point is that I actually think the whole Varsity Blues scandal is worthwhile for revealing the desperation and seamy underbelly of the admissions process, which a lot of anyone who's gone through it can attest to. But again, it's this idea of kids who don't even really need or want to go to college being funneled in and bribed in by extremely wealthy or well-connected parents because the parents care about the status. I think as a matter of exposure, it's good that it happened, but there are probably a lot more serious crimes that the Justice Department could be pursuing right now.
I'll conclude by saying I just read this extraordinary novel on this very subject by a man named Bruce Holsinger called The Gifted School, which is about It's a semi-satirical, semi-not-satirical novel about the creation of a gifted and talented school in what is clearly Boulder, Colorado, and these four mothers of 11-year-olds who start going absolutely insane trying to get their kids into this school. And I, if you are a reader of the contemporary novel, it's one of the best you'll find, and I strongly recommend it, The Gifted School by Bruce Holzinger. And with that, we bring this to a close. For Abe Greenwald, Noah Rothman, and Christine Rosen, I'm John Podhoretz. Have a great Labor Day weekend, and keep the candle burning.